CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 19. Today with Douglas Koch. Dr. Koch is an ophthalmologist specializing in anterior segment surgery, specifically cataract and refractive surgery, at Baylor University in Texas. I first met Dr. Koch many years ago when I was a medical student, flew into Baylor to interview with him, and he has just a magnetic personality. When you talk to him, you can tell he's incredibly bright, but he's also incredibly humble and easy to approach. Really an amazing combination. I've often said, if I had a quarter of Doug Koch's brain, I'd be a genius. And I say that completely with a straight face. He's that incredible. Now, I also enjoy learning from him. He's taught us so much about the posterior cornea. You remember all that? That was Dr. Koch. Or axial length modification for the high myopes to do IOL calculations more accurately. All these things originated from him. Truly a brilliant man, so much to learn, such a sweet person. I really love this podcast, and I'm sure you will too. Check it out. I want to welcome you guys back to our Cataract Coach podcast, and today we have one of my absolute idols in ophthalmology, Doug Koch from Baylor. I first met Dr. Koch when I was a fourth-year med student interviewing for ophthalmology residency, and don't tell anyone, especially my kids, it was 1995. I graduated med school in 96, and when I interviewed there at Baylor, and back then, this was before COVID, before Zoom, we interviewed in person, I was blown away with this program. The amount of hands-on skill that you learn by doing at a huge VA, a huge county-type hospital, and more importantly, faculty who were so incredibly passionate. Ultimately, I chose to do residency at UCLA because of family reasons, close to home, but I've always had a fond place in my heart for Baylor, and in fact, in the last 20 years of UCLA ophthalmology residency, we've taken at least one Baylor med student every year for 20 years. So that hammers home the point that I'm a big fan of the Baylor program. So Doug, welcome to our podcast. And again, you are one of my absolute idols in the ophthalmology space.
Thanks, Uday. It's really a pleasure to be here. And I am always so blown away by all you have done and contributed with Cataract Coach, which is such an amazing resource. Really, really a wonderful contribution to our field.
Yeah, well, as you know, the more you teach, the more you learn. I learn far more than I contribute. It's almost a guilty pleasure.
You know, and that's so true. Even with everything we do in our clinic with our trainees, whether it's a student or a resident or a fellow, there are always everyday questions that I get asked that I don't know the answer to that, and I got to go think about it and try to figure it out. And some of those questions have led to some nice research projects, so yeah.
Absolutely, and we'll certainly delve into that. But you also did a lot of teaching in cities all over the U.S., and in fact, all over the planet, to really get the word out decades ago about the earlier innovations in ophthalmology, whether it be refractive or on the cataract side. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, you know, I was privileged as a resident to work under Jared Embry, and he taught us phaco as residents, and I finished my residency in 1981. So
There
I am doing phaco on softer lenses,
sure,
before capsular rexus, before any kind of technique to bring it up. You know, we just kind of winged it. But and then extra cap came in, but then in the sort of the early-ish 80s, around 1985, I jumped back into phaco in a bigger way, and then I started teaching it because I thought this is obviously the way to go. Now, we didn't have good foldable lenses, so we were still enlarging incisions to put in 6mm lenses, but they were obviously really just right behind us in terms of their evolution. And so I did a lot of teaching. I traveled around the country. I taught numerous phaco courses in our institution for people who came from all over the place, and did live surgery. Glad I don't have to do that again.
That is stressful, for sure.
I've done it a bunch of places. It's stressful, but it's a great educational event, that's for sure. But and then in refractive surgery, I sort of was kind of thinking about what I wanted to do with my career, and cataract and refractive just seemed so kind of close to me, even in the 1980s. So I jumped in, I did a little RK, and then I backed away and said, you know, there's just something that feels uncontrolled about this. And sure, as it turned out, you know, that's how it came about in terms of people's long-term results. And then Exmer Laser came along, and we got involved very early, thanks to really support from a lot of people. Dan Dury got me my first microkeratome on a loan so I could start doing LASIK.
Wow.
So there are a lot of people that taught me a lot of stuff along the way, and then I decided that's an important thing to do research on. And we really focused our research at that point on complications and how to manage them and prevent them, DLK, striae, that kind of thing. So
back to the FACO days, when you were teaching FACO, this may be before most of our audience, no clear corneal incisions. You're doing a scleral tunnel that you're enlarging to about 6 millimeters for non-foldable ends, and it's before the advent of capsulorhexis, so you're doing a can opener or a Christmas tree or some other type of capsulotomy.
Exactly. And at that point, too, there was no hydrodissection.
Oh, wow.
It came in as we were still doing can openers, but initially there was no hydrodissection. We were just kind of breaking the nucleus up and just trying to suck out the pieces. The fluidics were terrible. There was very little control of the aspiration and flow rate and chamber stability. But, most of the patients turned out great. And we were doing superior incisions, superior scleral tunnels. I mean, sure. Unthinkable in this day and age, in terms of that kind of challenge, except for, of course, the mini extra cap procedure that's so wonderful for developing nations.
Yeah, the SICS, or the manual small incision cataract surgery, which when I was teaching residents, I made it a point to teach basically every resident how to do this. It's that magical of a procedure that I still do in Beverly Hills at least a couple times a year.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed to say I really have never mastered that. I'm just gutted out with FACO, but if I really had an opportunity, which I hope to someday, to travel and do more overseas, I will study the feet of you and people like Jeff Petty and others who are so wonderful at teaching this.
Yeah, it's an amazing procedure, but I'll admit my experience is maybe, even when teaching residents, maybe 30, 40 cases a year, so not a whole lot, because if you go to other countries, surgeons will do 50 of these a day, 100 of these a day.
Right.
So it's like, It's a humbling thing. Yeah, but what strikes me is that what you do today is nothing like what you were taught when you did your training. Nothing.
Totally true. The things I got out of my training were the things that really help you take good care of patients. My mentor, Jared Emery, was always listening to patients and talking with patients and trying to understand where they were coming from. And my chairman, Dan Jones, was such a wonderful mentor about thinking about problems, looking hard at the patient, and never taking anything for granted. And so those two people had a huge influence on the way I kind of think about things. And then once you develop a mindset of curiosity, collaboration, concentration, and hard work, a lot of good things happen.
Yeah, it's funny. And you say it's patient-centric. It's you learn from these mentors basically how to deliver the best care to that patient, irrespective of the technique or the technology.
Absolutely right. And the other wonderful thing is most of my research interests have sprung from handling challenging patient clinical problems. IOL calculations after LASIK, the posterior cornea, all these complications from refractive surgery. These are things that I encountered in my practice, and I thought, something isn't clicking here. We need a better way to do this.
Tell me more about the posterior cornea thing, because it's as obvious as it sounds. The first time I heard your lecture about posterior cornea, I was blown away because I never even thought of it. And then when you said it, it obviously made sense. I was like, well, of course.
Well, it was a curious thing. We had just gotten the Galilei, and I said, I don't know that anybody's really paid any attention to the posterior cornea. Let's look at it.
Sure.
And we had this wonderful medical student, Shazia Ali. And Shazia did all this work gathering data from 738 eyes. And with my colleague Lee Wong and Mitch Weichert and Liz Yu, we analyzed these data. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks that there was something really going on here.
Yeah.
But along with that, I had this, what I would call a seminal patient. And this patient was an engineer. He had with the rule of astigmatism. He had 1.5 diopters on the anterior cornea. And he was very inquisitive. He said, how do you know what strength of the toric lens to pick? And I said, well, I was in the clinical trial. I know what to pick.
Sure.
So sure enough, I picked a 1.5 diopter lens that I flipped as astigmatism. He ended up with 3/4 of a diopter against the rule. Uh-huh. And then I had a lady who had against the rule astigmatism, who I undercorrected in the first eye, and I didn't believe my results, so I undercorrected the second eye. It's like, oh, no, you've got to be kidding me. And those two patients, folding that into what I was finding on the posterior cornea, and it turns out a lot of people had thought about posterior cornea.
Yeah.
And I went back and Duke Elder in the late 1800s, Schoenig, from a Danish ophthalmologist who invented one of the aberrometers that's used in the Alcon wavelight aberrometer, he actually postulated there was posterior corneal astigmatism.
Wow.
Based on his findings. And other, you know, Javal came up with stuff, and there was a lot of stuff going on, but nobody had tied it to the difference between with the rule eyes and against the rule eyes, and certainly nobody had applied it to toric IOL calculations. And that was the start of the whole thing.
Yeah, even for me, I remember seeing patients before you came out with this, and I didn't understand. The patient would end up perfect plano by some stroke of luck. As we know, to end up have that patient that's zero sphere, zero sill, is a little bit of luck, and it only happens every so often. But I'd look at those eyes, and then I'd see the auto K's, the keratometer printout that shows, yeah, he's perfectly spherical, zero, cylinder zero, but the patient has 0.5 or 0.75 diopters on the anterior cornea of with the rule. I'm like, but how? It was a non-toric lens.
And everybody attributed it to lens tilt.
Right.
Everybody said, oh, it's lens tilt. And don't get me wrong, lens tilt does play a role, but we're not finding lens tilt to play as much of a role as we kind of thought it might. Work by Oliver Findl's group and our group, and Mitch Weichert has done some wonderful work with Lee Wong and ZMAX, and we're not finding as much contribution from lens tilt as we thought. So there are still some big mysteries in toric IOL calculations, the posterior cornea is still hanging in there. It's a big one.
What do you think some of the mysteries are? I mean, obviously, we're learning that AC depth is obviously going to play a role because where the IOL sits. But and what else do you think would be important in toric cornea?
I don't think we have a good measurement yet of the posterior cornea. I think that's one of the fundamental weaknesses. There may be some other issues like surgically induced astigmatism and some other things, but you know, it's interesting. For example, the IOMeister 700, which gives you these marvelous readings and consistently sort of underplays the role of the posterior cornea when it does the final calculation for total corneal power. And yet, if you do a toric IOL calculation based on that total keratometry alone, you're still going to undercorrect with the rule, overcorrect with the rule, and undercorrect against the rule eyes. So is that posterior corneal measurement really right?
Yeah.
There's something still going on. There's still something we need to sort out. We're working on it, but we haven't cracked that one yet. Toric IOL formulas that are based on mathematical formulas based on only the anterior cornea, they're still consistently doing almost as well as any formula that incorporates the posterior cornea. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, not a whole lot of difference. I mean, I personally was humbled when I thought many years ago, I did this study comparing residents' surgically induced astigmatism to mine. And I thought, well, I've got these tens of thousands of cases under my belt. I'll be so much more accurate. And of course, the humbling part is we both, the resident group and me personally, the spread of SIA or surgically induced astigmatism was pretty wide. I thought it'd be this nice, tight, narrow bell curve. No, it's this big, wide spread.
Right. It's crazy, isn't it? Some of it's got to be measurement variability.
Yeah.
Some of it is, if I have my trainees, if I find them doing an anterior, approach, those patients, at least early on in the postoperative period, and by early on, I mean even as late as 3 weeks, they'll have one diopter of induced astigmatism against the incision location.
Yeah.
But it does fade over time. But there's more, it's biological tissue.
Right.
Yeah, it's going to constantly kind of give us a challenge.
Well, then you think of also corneal elasticity, how it varies with age, corneal diameter, the white-to-white measurement, corneal pachymetry, kind of all these things play a role. I mean, that 2.2 incision in a cornea that's 10.5 millimeters wide is going to be different than in a cornea that's 12.5 millimeters wide.
Oh, that's so true. So true.
It's kind of just all over the place. Tell me, what got you? I see you as an absolute godfather in ophthalmology, especially in the category of refractive side. You've done so much. How did you get so interested in ophthalmology when you went to med school? Is it something you always had an interest in?
I grew up in a small town in Michigan, Port Huron, Michigan. And my father was a physician. His father had been a farmer. And so we lived in a small town. And just down the street from us was a guy named Nicholas Duvas. And Nick Duvas invented the second vitrector.
You know, wow.
And so he had people coming from all over the world to his little home on the lake, and where he would show videos and teach people how to do vitrectomies with a Duvas roto extractor.
Wow.
Now, it was eclipsed by what Mockamer did.
Sure.
But that was my first sort of teaser. But I kind of lucked into it because I was in medical school. I had made all my applications for residency in pediatrics. And in July of between my third and fourth year, I took an ophthalmology rotation at Mass Eye and Ear, where I was a medical student. And I went, Oh my goodness, I gotta do this. I think it was when I first looked in the slit lamp and saw an eye and saw what the potential was to look at it and do things with it and hear people talk about things from the standpoint of cataract surgery, glaucoma, corneal surgery, and so on. It's like, this is what I wanna do. So I quickly applied, last minute, and guess what? I misspelled ophthalmology in my application.
No, that's too funny. I love it.
OPTH, oh boy. That's what happened. But the funny thing is, to kind of carry that one step further, I was also going to become a pediatric ophthalmologist. I was working under my mentor at those days in pediatric ophthalmology was Gunter von Norden. Brilliant man, who, in addition to all his work on strabismus, did all this work on amblyopia and the neurological aspects of amblyopia. And I thought that was so amazing. And I had a fellowship all lined up. And in the middle of my third year, my mentor in cataract surgery, Jared Emery, said, you know, I could use a partner. I went, wow. And then a week later, I had already lined up a fellowship with Art Jampolsky and Scott, Alan Scott, in San Francisco, and I got a letter from them saying that the funding for the fellowship fell through.
Oh boy.
So, and I was already very attracted and attached to a Houston girl. So, job, payment, Houston girl, big career change.
So, yep, sounds like a plan.
And in those days, cataract surgeons were not in academic centers. Jared Emery was the only academician who is really seriously doing cataract surgery as a primary emphasis. And all the stories about the buccaneers of cataract surgery and people doing wild and crazy things. And I was a pretty conservative guy from a little town in Michigan. So I thought, I don't know what I'm getting myself into. I may be way in over my head. But, you know, things happen.
Yeah, it's funny, right? The saying is, life is what happens to you when you're busy trying to plan for it.
Absolutely.
So sometimes it's like, okay, you take it as it comes.
Absolutely right.
Well, that's neat. Yeah, so I had a very similar thing. I just happened to do an ophthalmology rotation, end of my third year, beginning of my fourth year of med school. And when I saw a patient with a white cataract have this elegant, like 10, 15 minute surgery, and then seize normally the next day, I thought I witnessed an actual miracle.
That's a great story. Yes. Absolutely.
So it just absolutely blew my mind.
It's either, you know, Ms. Jones, I'm going to add another blood pressure medicine to your regimen.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to make you see tomorrow.
Right. It's a complete, to this date, white cataracts are like my favorite. And I try my best to be so gentle, minimally invasive, atraumatic, recoat the endothelium with viscoelastic multiple times, because I want the post-op day one wow of 20/20 or close to it vision.
Isn't that the truth? I do the same thing. You want them the next day to just be weeping with joy.
Yeah, it's amazing. You also taught me, you were probably the first to ever tell me that cataract surgery is our most powerful refractive procedure. Because when I was a resident in like late 1990s, cataract surgery was one thing, refractive surgery was another. They weren't married.
Right. Oh, that's so true. But I credit, again, my mentor, Jared Emery, because I did a weird fellowship. I spent time with David McIntyre in Bellevue, Washington, and he was doing manual extracap, beautiful, elegant manual extracap, because these were the extracap days. I spent time with James Rousey, Jim Rousey in Oklahoma, and he was the one that was doing RK and using the corneoscope with Placido rings to start to understand corneal measurements. But the cataract refractive link came by working with Clifford Terry in California, in Orange County, Fullerton. And Cliff invented the Terry keratometer, which was an intraoperative keratometer that you would use at the end of surgery to adjust your sutures to get just the right amount of, with the rule of astigmatism, so that as it faded, hopefully you would end up with the right amount of the correct final amount of astigmatism. As it turns out, you know, with extracapsular surgery, that was a vain quest. Sure. But the concept of, you know, really controlling the astigmatism with surgery was planted in my brain by that exposure to Cliff. So I owe him that.
Yeah, so now it's crazy to think that, I mean, you can't think of cataract surgery without thinking of the refractive component. It's just that's an integral part of it. Whereas in the past, yeah, it had nothing to do with it.
Right. So true.
So in that light, also now looking at the lens counts, one of the other things that I loved from what you and Lee Wong and your group at Baylor did was the Wong-Koch axial length adjustment for high myopes. Because we've all been there. We've had these eyes. This is back, let's say, 20 years ago, 15 years ago. You have them highly myopic eyes where you say, oh, well, just use the SRKT formula. And you aim for minus a quarter and they end up plus a half. And you're like, what happened? So how did you know those eyes had to be adjusted?
Well, one of those C's I mentioned, collaboration.
Sure.
Lee came to me one day and said, you know, we'd been beating our heads against the wall for that same issue for you. And she said, you know, I just played around with optimizing the axial length, and I think it's going to work. So she came up with an initial formula. We worked on it. And sure enough, all of a sudden, the spread went from this to this. And it was amazing how tight it made everything. And, you know, when we introduced that to the world, we got a lot of pushback. And some of it was legitimate. Some of it was based from some of the ray tracing docs who said, well, it's because you're using these artificially high values for K readings in the IOL calculation formulas. But still nobody was getting as accurate results as we were with this regression method. And then, you know, Graham Barrett saw it and he folded that into his formula along with some other stuff, but it just spread like wildfire. And so a lot of people are still doing optimizing in their formulas, or they at least are doing other ways to really try to account for that. But it's, when you think about it, a long eye patient shouldn't have a problem with effective lens position because the IOL power is relatively low.
Yeah.
So, you know, you ought to be pretty darn accurate. And, we just looked at some data that Warren Hill gave us of 1,600 eyes, and we were 93% within a half diopter. You know, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
on your point, if your IOL power is zero, let's say ultra high myope, or even a one diopter lens, if it's zero, certainly where you put that lens in the eye, the affected lens position has nothing to do with it. So these low dioptric powers, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, then it begs the question, should we optimize for all axial lengths then, different optimization? Or should we do it for all K ranges or all AC depth ranges?
We've done a couple of papers on that topic of looking at segmenting the axial lengths.
Sure.
In other words, there's a different refractive index for the cornea, for the aqueous, for the lens, and for the vitreous. And you should take that entire optical pathway and break it down into its elements and adjust each element that way. And we found that it helps a little bit. We thought it might help more for short eyes where we have all this problem, these short eyes are all over the place. It hasn't really panned out. And I think that's because most of the formulas have done such a good job of incorporating this stuff in their kind of regression approach that it hasn't made that much of a difference. So, I mean, do I think that we'll ultimately be doing that routinely? Sure. But, right now, we're still, we're still stumbling over corneal measurements and ELP.
Right.
Right? I mean, right, that's just, yeah, those are still our bugaboos, right? Those are the ones that are, and for the eyes with irregular corneas, you know, with irregular astigmatism, certainly the contribution of the cornea to the refractive power is difficult to pin down, and that's another element, which is where ray tracing ought to really shine.
Right. It also begs the question that, is the concept of an A constant reasonable?
Yeah.
To the point where, I mean, because that's like, you raise all eyes or lower all eyes? And you can't like treat like this ultra high myope eye with a 29 millimeter axial length compared to in a 4 millimeter deep AC compared to that 19 millimeter axial length eye with the cornea power of 50 and an AC depth of 2. You can't like, but the A constant treats them the same.
That is so true. And of course, clinicians in practice, they don't have the time to optimize their constants, right, for each axial length. I think that's where an interesting role of AI is. I mean, look at Warren Hill's formula. Warren doesn't calculate an effective lens position. Warren just says, here's this incredible network of data of all these parameters. And if, you know, Mr. Smith has this, this, and this, and this, that's the IOL. It's kind of interesting. And, you know, Zeiss has done an interesting thing with their new formula. I don't know if you know about the Zeiss AI IOL calculator. They start off by ray tracing 500,000 eyes with all kinds of data points.
Sure.
So that they kind of train the data set, and then they get data from Veracity and go through it and develop a formula from it, constraining the data by the 500,000 eyes. And I tell you, that's looking pretty good. We did a study we're publishing on short eyes that shows it's the most accurate formula out there. Now, it's still not great. It's only like 75% within a half, sure, diopter for short eyes, but it's an interesting approach where you're using ray tracing and AI.
Yeah. I on a recent podcast, I also talked to Randy Olson from Utah, another absolutely brilliant person who, I mean, he talked about refractive index shaping, of adjusting the refractive index of any existing IOL in the eye with a femtosecond laser after the fact. And that just sounds like, wow, all you got to do is just, for a lens cocks now, just get the ball on the green and then use that to just sink the putt.
Right. It's a bigger challenge than it seems to be. And I think that I work with one of the companies, Perfect Lens, and they're doing interesting work on it. But it's a challenge because to change the power and create that new refractive lens within the lens takes a fair amount of time, and the fixation of the eye is so critical. There's still things to be worked out. Where I think that's going to go is companies are going to develop biomaterials for IOLs that are easy to adjust that way.
Makes sense.
The treatment might take 10 seconds instead of 2 minutes. It'll be interesting to see where it goes. But it is a really intriguing approach. And obviously, that leads us to the whole conversation about post-op modification, which is so interesting and, I think, obviously growing in interest among all of us.
Yeah, so I always think of the leap. The leap we went from manual extra cap with these can openers and these sutures and non-photo lenses to where we are today. And then now the next leap to like this, you know, adjustable lenses and whatever, even a combination of lenses, doesn't seem like that much of a more of a leap.
I know, isn't that crazy?
Right?
It's amazing. It's just amazing. The accommodative lenses, I think, are still befuddling us. I don't think we're there yet. You know, you look at all the data that are out there, you know, they kind of turn into a kind of an EDOF, kind of quality to what they can do. So we're still a long ways from that, and I still have questions about the long-term function that they're going to provide.
I mean, the good thing, though, with the accommodating lenses, with so many horses in that race, I think one of them's going to cross the finish line.
Yeah.
Not sure when or not sure which one. Obviously, I have my own horse in the race in that. But I think it's a neat concept. I think we're also learning along the way. Like, I worked, as my disclosure, I did the first LensGen Juvine IOLs back in 2015 in Panama. I did the first ones ever.
Wow.
And that was really, yeah, that's a really neat thing. It's been 8 years. But what the amazing part was by keeping the capsule bag fully open, there's been like a zero PCO rate. No posterior capsule calcification, period. Which you would never expect.
I know, it's crazy, isn't it?
So it's like
we saw that.
Yeah.
We did. I was in the trial, clinical trial for the Synchrony. Remember that?
Sure.
That silicone lens that had a high anterior optic that so that when the capsule would contract, it would move forward.
Yep.
Those capsules were totally clear. Like you said, I did 10 patients, and this was like 15 years ago. I've done one YAG out of those 10.
Yeah, it's wild. I was in Brazil a month ago at the Brazilian cataract refractor meeting. By the way, an amazing meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And I love these Brazilian ophthalmologists. But Liliana Werner presented a paper of hers from Utah about like these things about keeping the bag open and how that prevents PCO. And I was like, wow, it just blew my mind. This is nothing we would not have even thought of it 10 years ago.
No. Yeah, again, it's just good observation of when you try something and you get an observation and you go, wow. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's a fantastic time to be an ophthalmologist. I tell both of my kids, like, listen, this is an amazing field. I can't tell you how happy I am. I am cuckoo right. for cataracts. I just can't get enough.
It's so true. Yeah.
Where do you think we're going then in the future with this? In the future of ophthalmology as a whole? And also, I also want to get your input on academic ophthalmology. You have a very keen insight there. And one of the challenges I see is that we still only train 450, 460 ophthalmologists a year for all of the USA.
Yeah, that's we really do need more. I mean, obviously, we're all getting busier and busier.
Sure.
And, you know, a lot of physicians, as we know, are dropping out. A lot of physicians dropped out for COVID. Others are just kind of getting burned out by the whole kind of insurance and all the kind of hassles. So I think that's a very legitimate concern throughout medicine and certainly for ophthalmology as well. It's funny because 20 years ago, we thought we were going to have a surfeit of ophthalmologists. Right. We're going to have too many. And then within like 5, 6, 7, 8 years, they said, whoops, got that wrong. We're not going to have enough. I worry about academic ophthalmology because of how expensive it is to run a medical school.
Yeah.
And the deans in medical schools are under great pressure from their boards, from their, you know, the university chancellors to perform financially. And they, you know, they have to also teach medical students and do a lot of things that are not sufficiently remunerative to pay for the cost that they generate. So that means that surgeons like doctors like myself in academic settings, a fair amount of our income goes to supporting the college, the medical school. And so, you know, young doctors coming out, particularly if they come out carrying a big burden of debt from loans, student loans, you know, they got to look around and say, well, I can go into academics, but, you know, so you have to do as much as you can to kind of help them financially. And, you know, when I started practice, we had a surplus of money in our department. We could do all kinds of things. And then the dean started taking more and more.
The dean's tax.
The dean's tax got higher. Yeah. And the other thing that happened is if we would generate a surplus at the end of the year, instead of being able to retain it and use it for development within the department and do things for the faculty, the dean said, thank you very much. And I don't criticize them for that. I understand they're under this pressure from above. But I think it's a challenge in medical schools because of all those sort of factors. And I do worry about, you know, retaining and generating interest among young physicians to join and become academic ophthalmologists, certainly teaching ophthalmologists. Mm. I mean, one of the salvations that I've seen is that many private practices do a wonderful job of contributing in that way. You're a great example of that. You're a master teacher. You've devoted a tremendous amount of time to it, and yet you have your practice. So you've recognized the need, and you have the joy of teaching. But we need a gazillion more UDAs, you know?
Yeah. It's tough, though. I mean, the challenge is there. I was very happy. I did half-time private practice and half-time teaching residents for 22 years. And I estimate about 10,000 resident cases attended total. So pretty good clip. About 200 residents, because we're a big program. We're 80 years at UCLA. And I really enjoyed it, but I just felt that there was a lot more uphill battle regarding bureaucracy, administration, those kind of things that really took away a lot of the joy of it for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when they said, I asked, what's the earliest I can retire and get the pension? They said 52. I said, hey, just so happens I just turned 52. Thanks. And I just, to me, it's not a dropping the microphone moment. It's more of a passing the baton, though. And right. the new person who's taking over my spot, which is at a big county hospital called Olive View, UCLA Med Center, which is a fantastic facility. I love the place, love the patients, love the nurses. Is a really fantastic young ophthalmologist. He's a retina specialist from Bascom, probably 40-ish years old, named Jay Sridhar. And he runs a great podcast from the cutter's mouth, the retina podcast. I think he'll do an amazing job. He has my full support. And it's time for him to shine. I don't want to keep sitting at that position.
All right. Yeah, and one of the things I've tried to do in my practice is really layer in my successors.
Yeah.
So, Mitch Weichert, who's sort of 10, 15 years behind me. And then there's, Sumitra Candlewall. And then we have Masih Ahmed, who's, you may not know, but you will know, he's this marvelous guy. He's been in our practice for 3 years now. He's already our residency director. Incredible guy. And we're bringing Allison Chen into our practice, and she's a very creative, very energetic woman. So I'm hoping that everybody will stay and hang in there, and that the department will create an environment or preserve an environment and makes them want to continue to do what we do.
Yeah, it's fun to pass the baton to the young ones. It's so neat. It is. It gives you back that young energy. Like people say, why do you attend residence? I say, because it just gives me energy to see this young person, the smile on their face, and they finally figure out that chop. It's amazing.
It is a great feeling. There's no question about it. It's just unbeatable to see residents grow and, see these first-year residents come in and, no, you've got to do it this way and that way. And actually, a lot of that teaching now is done by some of my junior colleagues who have this amazing patience and joy in taking the young residents. I kind of get more of the senior residents, which is also fun, trying to take them through the more complex cases.
For sure. And you also have an amazing fellowship. When I was a resident, I was finishing my residency, I only looked at three fellowships. I looked at your fellowship at Baylor, which I thought was amazing. I looked at Dick Lindstrom's in Minneapolis. And then I looked at the time, Peter McDonald was still at UC Irvine. I looked at his. Those are the only three I looked at. Ultimately, I decided that I don't know if I needed the fellowship. I was driven enough to learn on my own. So I opted not to do a fellowship. But tell me more about yours, because back then it was absolutely one of the top on my radar.
Yeah, I think we have a great fellowship because we have this really such a diverse faculty. I mean, Steve Flugfelder, he's like the world's best guy in the ocular surface. Bose Hamill, who does all kinds of intricate and interesting surgery, iris surgery and that kind of thing. Mitch Weichert, who does it all and does it all incredibly well. Sumitra Candlewall, who was a Lindstrom Fellow and from that group, Minnesota Eye Consultants, and brought all these skills, and she's multi-talented and so organized and so focused on the teaching mission. And then Masih Ahmed. So we have a lot of people, and I do. I have this refractive background for teaching, getting them trained in the STAR S4 and LASIK and all that kind of thing. So we have this diversity of people with their specialty and special interests. And it really, I think it makes a really rich experience. So we usually have fantastic fellows, and we have such a wonderful time with them. They're lifelong buddies,
Yeah, they really are.
You work so closely with them, for a year.
You also have an amazing facility for different hospitals, different teaching sites. You get a huge patient population, a very varied pathology.
Yep, absolutely. We have county hospitals, just crazy busy, and then our VA was super busy, and then our own clinical practices at Baylor.
Yeah, that just makes it for a fantastic kind of mixed, group of patients to do everything. Do you think we'll get to the point where we're doing more fellowships that are like yours? Because in the old days, it was kind of like a more cornea fellowship, and there were some other glaucoma fellowship, but there wasn't really a cataract refractive type fellowship until kind of you and Lindstrom and maybe Peter McDonald kind of pioneered that. Are we getting more and more of that now?
It's interesting. The AUPO, which oversees the corneal fellowship, does really a great job. That came from the cornea background. And so the primary numbers that you have to meet are corneal, PKPs, DMACs, DSECs. But they're branching out. They're thinking about adding complex cataracts to the mix, IOL exchanges, which I've been pushing them to do.
Sure.
Because a cornea specialist needs to know how to do that stuff. And they're adding a little bit of exposure to cross-linking. And then if you have a refractive component to your fellowship, certain basic numbers. I think there are going to be a lot of people who are going to do purely cataract and cornea. I think there'll be a small subset of them that'll be doing refractive. I don't think that we'll see a huge... Refractive is such its own special deal with its own special requirements. You know that very well. And so I think that there'll be some fellowships that try to do it all, like we do, and there'll be some that say, I'm going to be almost only cornea, and others, they're going to be more cornea cataract. I will say that the fellows that I bring in, I do teach them cataract surgery. It sounds kind of funny, but
no, for sure.
There's a lot to learn from residency, even though they come from wonderful programs. There's so much still to learn. Well, heck, I'm still learning, so what can I tell you? So,
well, that's actually very sage advice. If you're a young ophthalmologist, so you're a resident, and you think, wow, I've got this great residency, I'm going to do 300 phacos or more during my residency, I hate to be the one to tell you, that's not even halfway up the cataract learning curve. It's a secret. You'll find out. When you hit Ks 1,000, you'll say, oh, wow, 300 was just baby steps. But you're right.
Yeah.
And we continue to learn. That's another caveat. You know, if I had done this cornea fellowship 20 years ago, DSEC, DMEC weren't invented. Right. If I had done a retina fellowship 20 years ago, there was no OCT. There was no anti-VEGF.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is, like we talked at the beginning of this conversation, you've taught yourself, whatever you do today is nothing of what you were taught. You were taught the basic building blocks and patient interaction skills. But everything you do now, you've learned along the way.
Totally. It's amazing. And that's what's so cool about our field.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not only, you know, cognitive learning, which is huge in our field, but skill learning, acquisition of new abilities and skills, which is constantly challenging and so exciting.
Yeah. And the neat part, too, is that we're so visual, obviously, in the surgery, but even how we learn. And we have these, obviously, surgery with a microscope. We've got a camera there. I hate to even admit, but I probably want 30 minutes to an hour of surgical videos a day. I'm just so bananas about learning this. Like, I don't watch Netflix. I don't watch HBO. I watch YouTube videos. This is what I do.
Wow.
And part of it, too, is for cataract coach, I get submitted 5 or 10 videos are sent to me a day. And I want to give them the honor of watching all of them. So I learn from them. That's how I learned DMEC. I watched a video of DMEC of some amazing surgeons. Martin Dürresheimer from Austria, Peter Veldman, University of Chicago. They make it look so easy. So I watched their video. I pieced them together. I emailed them. And I said, hey, do you mind if I put these 10 videos of yours together into like a compilation and I'll put it up on Cataract Coach? I watched it 50 times before my first DMEC.
Wow.
So I went in there, did a DMEC with a resident. I just tell you, it looks much easier than it actually is. But finally, like 6, 8, 10 DMECs later, I was pretty good, and I just kept teaching the residents. But yeah, that's how we learn. It's all watching. And now the amazing part is your phone. You can watch this anywhere on the planet in high definition on your mobile phone.
It's unreal. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just
totally unreal. Yeah. Well, I mean, look what COVID showed us, too, about, distant learning or remote learning. We had people from India doing these fantastic meetings, pulling people from all over the world, 2 days worth of meetings during at the height of COVID when nobody was traveling, speakers from here, there, everywhere, Latin America, Asia, India, all over.
Yeah.
And it's just, what an amazing thing we have going now.
Yeah, that's why I started the cataract coach thing. I said, if I can make a video every day, 5 minutes. And just get one little point across. In a year, that's a lot of new learning for me and the viewers.
Right, for sure.
So, fun stuff. What advice would you have to young people who are now... Our podcast, our cataract coach website, obviously skews on the younger side. So most of the people who watch it are ages 30s and 40s. What advice do you have these young people for maximizing your learning, maximizing your career?
Well, I think you... Once you get into practice, you begin to figure out what you really like. Mm-hmm. You don't really know when you start practice. Do you like doing this? Do you like doing that? And I think you have to listen to yourself when you encounter that sort of moment. Do you want to be the person that spends a ton of time with patients and does a lot of personal counseling and helps them with, you know, very elaborate IOL discussions? Do you want to be a person who just wants to be super busy? Do you want to be a teacher? You want to have time for research? You know, you have to begin to carve your path. And I see people going all over the place. My fellows who have graduated have gone into academics and come back out. They've gone to private practice, gone into academics. And I think that obviously we all sort of sense that the younger generation, millennials and so on, are really much more attuned to the whole family thing and to a balance in their lives than maybe us baby boomers who are like, you know, pretty driven. And I think that's wonderful. But the other thing I would say is don't give up on meetings. Don't give up on going to meetings and don't rely only on videos and that sort of thing. Because when you go to a meeting and you hear people talk, then all of a sudden you're exposed to things you might not be exposed to if you're deliberately just saying, I'm going here, I'm going there, I'm going there. And I think there's something that's really expansive about being mixed with the crowd. You don't have to go to four meetings a year. Go to a couple. You know, go to Ascaris. Go to the academy, or go to a local meeting, and then that will supplement what you get from things like Cataract Coach, I think. But I fear that people are going to be pulled away more and more from that, and I think that's a loss to them in their growth.
I totally agree. Just meeting with colleagues at the ASCRS or the academy or other, even local, you said local meetings, that's where a lot of the discussions, you pick up the kind of the best pearls.
Yeah, and you hear things, you know, you bump into an Uday Devgan and you ask him a question and that leads to some other question and all of a sudden, then you're learning about how he managed his career and all this stuff can be learned that you don't listen or don't learn by just pushing a button on your computer and watching a podcast or a video. Not that I'm dissing those in any way. Those are so important. But it's the whole combination, I think, that enriches a person's professional growth.
Yeah, I know for sure. I think you need all of them. I think you benefit from all of them. And plus, meetings are fun. I love catching up with colleagues and seeing people, even for like a fleeting glance. Hey, how are you? Just to see them in person. There's something about the human nature. You need that human-human interaction.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, also to hear people argue and debate is fantastic, you know. No, Pelusin marginal generation has nothing to do with keratoconus. It's a part of keratoconus, you know. And then you start to talk about all the nuances of these topographic and corneal findings. You know, it's good stuff.
Yeah, I know it. You know that I love the point counterpoint. I did a cataract coach symposium at the ASCRS, and I chose two panelists, and I chose them because A, they're super smart, smarter than I am. I chose Rosa Bragamili. And from Toronto, and Deepinder Dhaliwal from Pittsburgh. Both absolute geniuses, incredible surgeons. And I know both of them personally, and they promised me they will bust my chops. They will put me through the grinder. So I showed a case, and here's what I did, and they were so, it was so good. The interaction, like, no, you should have done this differently, and no, and this.
Right.
That was the best learning. I learned so much.
Right. You couldn't have picked two better people. They are so brilliant and so strong and so right there.
Yeah. And not afraid to tell me what I did wrong. No, you should have done this.
Which probably is, not as gently as that.
No, but you know, that's the best part. It's just like, it's such great learning. If I got a little mad from other people, like, you know, Amar Agarwal, show your complications, show your nightmares. That's what, I'm not going to ever show you a cherry-picked case that makes me look slick. I'm going to show you a case that I said, I should have done something differently here. In fact, one of the cases I showed was a patient that I had a post-op problem with, a cataract surgery complicated with RK and ocular surface issues, and I sent him to you and Steve Flugfelder. You guys, woo, saved my skin. And so I used that case so I could summarize, well, what did we learn from the whole process? Because I know that the difference between a mistake and a lesson is you learn from the lesson. So let me say, here's what happened. Here's how it was resolved. Here's how these two guys in Houston saved me. And here are my take-home lessons.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that can help, hopefully, a lot of other surgeons out there
yeah.
when they get in the same situation.
And I'm sure some of my patients have found their way to you. So
it does end up being a pretty small world.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what advice do you have these guys besides? So you want to definitely go to these meetings. Obviously, keep up on learning. We talked about work-life balance, which I did a very poor job of early on. I did way too much traveling when my kids were young, and only later figured out that I missed out on so much.
Right.
So I think
that, I think people are clued into that much more so than we were. And you know, it's these are kind of troubling times. You know, when I was beginning practice and doing all this, America was the kingpin in the world, and you know, we finally got rid of the Soviet Union and the, sure. the Berlin Wall, and we kind of thought we were in this amazing time of open-mindedness and liberal democracy. The world has gotten challenging now. Yeah. There's a lot going on in the world, and so I think the only other advice I would give to people is be a little conservative about your finances and what you do, kind of mm-hmm. be, you know, start to build that nest egg early. I was taught to do that by my mentor, Jared Emery. Get your nest egg, build it, protect it. Don't put it in crypto. Put it in something conservative so that yeah. it grows in a conservative way. And, you know, build that nest egg early, because we don't kind of know what kind of ups and downs in the world and finances are going to occur. And you know, just keep building your practice and doing a great job so that you always will have work that you love and will be supporting your family.
Yeah, that's the neat thing with what we do. It's just, it's not work. It's so much fun. I mean,
yeah.
I could be on vacation. I could think, I know it's a beautiful time. It's a beautiful view. Look at what a beautiful city, but I kind of wish I was in the OR. I kind of wish I was doing surgery. And my family will say, Dad, what are you talking about? Look. How can you think of work? I'm like, it's not yeah. really, it's not really work. It's kind of
funny. That's funny.
But yeah, I also took those lessons to heart too. I lived like a resident for as long as I could after residency. Drove my 18-year-old Volkswagen Jetta with 200,000 miles on it. Like, I will drive this car till the wheels fall off. I'm going to live like a resident as long as possible.
There you go. Yeah. I was putting money away very early into a 401k and, you know, I was getting a little pushback from the family. We could have a nicer vacation. I said, well, I think you'll like me better later on.
It's true how that works out. So what do you yeah. think is coming finally for ophthalmology? I think we talked a little bit about accommodating lenses, maybe refractive index shaping for IOLs. What else do you think is coming down in the cataract refractive cornea world in the, let's say, 5, 10, 15-year mark?
Well, I think we're going to see a mini resurgence of refractive surgery, of corneal refractive surgery with procedures that are gentler on the cornea. I think SMILE and some of those other procedures show real promise to be a little less invasive. And some of the new femtosecond lasers for making flaps are, I think, amazing sure. from several companies. So the accuracy of refractive surgery and the modulation post-op, you know, we just got new information about treating haze with losartan. I mean, new things that are coming along that way. But I think we'll see a fair amount more refractive surgery. I think we'll see lens surgery at a younger age as things get safer. But I think we're still going to be limited by the risks of cataract surgery and lens surgery, particularly in axial myopes at a mm-hmm. young age. We have not solved that problem because of the risk of retinal detachment. But I think that we're going to be faced with a lot of cataracts to do and not enough of us to do them. And some of the high volume scenarios are going to have to really come to play for us to stay on top of things.
Right. I mean, with more and more of the population becoming myopic, you see some of the stats that 80% of Hong Kong and Singapore are youth. In fact, people under age 30 are 80% are myopic. And you see now, you see kids, 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds sitting in their stroller on an iPhone, playing some right. game or watching some movie. So the incidence of myopia thing is going to go up. I'm just thinking that what's natural is you get braces when you turn like 12, 13 years old. What did you just get keratorefractive surgery when you turn 20, 22?
Yeah. It's hard because we know you need an adjustable procedure because the 20-year-old is going to get progressively more myopic. You know, you could leave them plus two, which is not a bad thing to do, really. But it's tricky because of the need to be able to do something sequentially. We've talked for so long about, you know, we can do this at 20, we can do this at 30, we can do this at 40, you know, but you really can't. I mean, you really can't take someone who's had LASIK at 21, you lift their flap at 31, you might get epi and growth. You can do PRK, it's not quite as accurate. We haven't gotten to the point yet where we have really adjustable or repeatable procedures that's going to take us to, every decade, you change your clothes, you change your corneal power or whatever it is. I mean, there's discussion of refractive index shaving for the cornea, with the company Clario, brilliant people like Scott McRae working on it, but I haven't heard anything about where that is now and what kind of progress they're making. So that the silence on the airwaves is concerning, that it's not turning out the way they hoped.
Right. And then, as you said, hopefully we'll start to see probably more refractive lens exchange at younger and younger ages, maybe in people in their 50s. Well, when presbyopia really hits, we'll elect to do something that restores their range of vision.
Yeah, particularly for the emmetropic presbyopes and the hyperopic and the low myopic. I think the 26 millimeter and higher eyes will be, again, remain a bit of a concern. We keep thinking we can do these patients with impunity, and the data still show, you know, an unacceptably high risk of retinal detachment unless they're really in a bind.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we see that now with these axial myopes. Even they have a beautiful cataract surgery, and 2 years later, they've got a detachment. We've all seen that. We've all been there.
Right.
But certainly, I think it's an incredible time to be an ophthalmology. I think I'm like you. Every day, I'm thankful that I'm an ophthalmologist. Yeah. And just happy that I have this opportunity to help so many patients so many different ways.
Yeah, it's wonderful. We are really fortunate we're fortunate we got into this field, and we're fortunate we got in this field at this point in the field when it was undergoing this unbelievable transition, particularly for me. And my third year as a resident, I did an intercap, an extracap, and a phaco all in the same day.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
You know, because of the different lenses and the different... Yeah. So it's an interesting time for us now because of the continued refinement. But you and I both went through a period where it was explosion of technology that took us to where we are. And now we're building on that for these extra refinements. And I should have measured things like extra better measurements, better predictions, all kinds of things that are going to happen to make things better. It's just a great field to be in.
Right. I may have to add for our younger audience members, an intracap. What is an intracap? You may have to explain this, Doug. Intracap, they kind of know extracap. That's like SICS, but an older version. Can you explain what intracap is? Because I bet you a lot of young ophthalmologists do not know.
So you do a conjunctival peritomy, and you fold the conjunctiva over. You make a huge, long 10, 11 millimeter incision, and you take some forceps, and you lift up the cornea. You may inject alpha chymotrypsin to weaken the zonules. And then you take a cryoprobe and you put it on the lens and you just gently move the lens back and forth, hoping against hope that you don't break the lens capsule. And then you work that lens out through this huge incision and hope that the mother vitreous doesn't follow you.
Wow. Yeah, I've actually
and
never,
then you put
I've
it down
one.
And do a zillion sutures. And then the patients break their hips with a fall, 6 months later because they don't have an IOL.
Yeah, just wow. I mean, yeah, you're right. The distance we've come in the last couple decades is unbelievable.
Yeah.
But I just think, honestly, when some people say, well, we missed the golden era of ophthalmology, it was back in the day. I think, no, just wait. The next 10, 20, 30 years, you'll be amazed. We'll do even more amazing things.
I completely agree. There's so many brilliant people working in so many interesting areas. It's phenomenal.
Right. And in fact, there are a ton of brilliant people. So if any of the young ophthalmologists think, gosh, everyone ophthalmology is smarter than me, believe me, this is my sentiment. I feel like I'm dumber than a bucket of rocks because you're around people in ophthalmology who are so incredibly brilliant. But whatever your flavor that you bring to the table is, believe me, that's well and good and plenty sufficient. So don't, remember, comparison to the thief of joy. Don't compare yourself to others. I learned this the hard way. I only compare myself to me. And I'm just asking for a 1% a year incremental improvement. It's all I ask.
And the other thing I would say is, when you're in practice and when you're taking care of patients, if you see something that doesn't make sense, that piques your interest, or you can't explain with anything, don't blow it off. Trust your instincts to explore it further and think about it. Because the germ of so many ideas comes from that very moment of puzzlement when you encounter a clinical problem. And it's amazing the number of people in all realms of ophthalmology who have made huge contributions by that, the insights that they come upon in their clinical practice.
Wow, that's probably a great end point, because you said at the beginning of this, you just noticed, wow, the patients seem like there's got to be some involvement with the posterior cornea based on your own patients in clinic. You had your own myopes in clinic where, gosh, I thought they were going to end up minus a half, and here they are plus a half. That piqued your interest for the axial length adjustment. You had patients who said, yeah, I did Archeon, and I don't think this is the right thing. You trusted your instincts, your judgment.
Right.
So yeah, really, exactly. You take it from your clinic, your clinical experience. When you notice something, don't ignore it. I love that point. Think about it. Put it on your back burner.
Yeah, there's a lot of noise out there that's telling you other things.
Right.
Trust your instincts.
Oh, that is fantastic. Well, thank you, Doug, for doing this interview. It's a big deal to me. Again, you've been one of my idols since I was a medical student, and I've learned so much from you over the years. I feel like it should probably pay you royalties. I've learned so much from you. So keep up the amazing work, and I'll remind you guys that, of course, we have a new Cataract Coach podcast every single week. Tune in, and you can download these on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, Google, anywhere you get your podcast. Plus, it's going to be on cataractcoach.com and, of course, on our YouTube channel. Thanks for watching.
All right. Thanks, Uday.
Thank you for enjoying that podcast with me. So much to learn from Doug Koch, and I can only imagine what he's going to innovate in the years to come. I want to remind you that we have this podcast also as audio-only version. Amazon, Apple, Spotify, Google, wherever you get your podcast from, you can get this podcast. It's also on YouTube as a video and, of course, on cataractcoach.com. I want to hear from you. Tell me your suggestions. What can we do better on this podcast? Who should we have as a guest? How should we take this podcast in the future? Do you like the format of about an hour as an interview with a well-known ophthalmologist? Let me know and give us some feedback. Appreciate it.